This programme is brought to you by the monthly partners of Reasons to Believe. For more information, please visit our website at reasons.org/monthly partner.
Welcome to Imago Dei, engaging minds created in the image of God. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, we continue with part two of a historical theological view with Gavin Ortlund. Ken, on the last podcast, we got to know Gavin quite a bit. Dr. Gavin Ortlund with a PhD from Fuller Theological Seminary, concentration in historical theology. In fact, his dissertation, Gavin, if I got this correct, The Doctrine of Heaven in Anselm of Canterbury's Proslogion, is that
That's correct? Right. You got it.
Okay, with an MDiv from Covenant Theological Seminary. We didn't talk about that very much. Yeah. Maybe we can get into that as well. There's a lot to talk about. But Ken, I know you want to cover three historical figures as well in this podcast.
That's right. Gavin is one of those kind of guys like me who has a real attachment to Christian thinkers through the centuries. And so I want to especially ask him about Anselm, but I also want to kind of hear his thoughts about Kierkegaard and C.S. Lewis. So, Gavin, let me ask you, when I think of Anselm, I think almost immediately of things like...
Give the dates, by the way,
for people
who are not aware of Anselm, the approximate date we're talking about in church history.
Yes.
For us lay people.
1033 to 1109.
That's
okay,
right.
Thank you.
That's right.
Yeah. So this is a long time ago for people like me.
So he is a medieval Christian thinker. Gavin, when I think about him, three things kind of pop into my mind, and I wonder if you might comment a little bit about each of them in whatever way you'd like to do it. I think about his view of faith and reason, faith seeking understanding. I also think about the ontological argument that he developed, and I'd like to hear maybe especially how that argument kind of came out of his devotional life. And then maybe thirdly, you might want to touch on maybe the theme behind Cur Deus Homo, you know, that Jesus being God and man somehow resolves issues. But you did your doctoral work on Anselm. How did you come to become interested in him and his ideas?
Yeah, I think my entry point was the same as a lot of people. It was the ontological argument. I think sometime in late high school, my oldest brother, Eric, gave me a book on philosophy of religion. And it was sort of selected readings in philosophy of religion. So, you know, you got faith versus reason as a section. You got miracles as a section. And one of the sections is theistic proofs. Mm-hmm. And so they had a brief sort of abstract of that argument from Anselm's Proslogion, the book that he wrote where he develops that argument. And then they had a contemporary version of it from Alvin Plantinga, who's a Christian philosopher. And I was just a senior in high school, I think. But I remember we were at the airport, and I was sitting there reading the sort of logical syllogism, like the 8 points of Plantinga's restatement of it. And I probably spent about half an hour trying to figure out, what's the catch here? You know, surely this argument cannot be sound, but I can't figure out what's wrong with it. It seems the conclusion seems to follow from the premises and so forth. And that was sort of the beginning of my interest in Anselm. It was just such a weird argument and such a different kind of argument. So for people listening to this, the ontological argument is one of the, you know, classical proofs of God's existence, along with teleological and cosmological. Some would include the moral argument too. And it's sort of an argument from the idea of God. And some says, look, in my mind, there's an idea of a being, a maximally perfect being, or what he calls a being, than which nothing greater can be thought. And he says, well, if it wasn't also in reality, it wouldn't be the being than which nothing greater can be thought, because that being would be greater.
Yeah.
So he said, therefore, it must also be in reality. And again, you have that intuition where you're thinking, okay,
something's fishy.
Exactly. What's the? But and so that was my entry point. Now, since then, the whole burden of my scholarship on Anselm has been to say that the ontological argument is actually not the main thing of the Proslogion. Mm-hmm. That occupies chapters 2 through 4 in a 26-chapter book that continues to kind of spiral upwards into this beautiful vision of heaven. So perhaps, you know, we can talk more about that as well.
Sure.
But it's a fascinating argument, and it's kind of a fun one to consider. For me, the value of that argument is not ever, you know, we've talked earlier about what would you say to a skeptic? Hmm. I don't think I'd ever pull out the ontological argument, you know.
But yet, maybe Christendom's most influential philosopher has adopted that, you know. So on one hand, it seems like, I don't know that I'd use it, but it has some, it carries a pedigree that's pretty significant.
You're talking about Plantinga.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And I think, you know, sometimes there can be a value in an argument that's beyond just the explicit conclusion. Mm-hmm. The very process can have value. And for me, personally, the value of that argument has been just helping my mind try to stretch upwards and think about God. Mm-hmm. Because you start to think about this God, then which nothing greater than can be thought. And it highlights God's uniqueness, God's absolute uniqueness. There's nothing else like God. And the argument is one way to kind of emphasize that.
Yeah, yeah. Talk to us a little bit, if you will. My understanding is Anselm was a very devout individual, you know, very influential in kind of shaping worship at the time, monastic ideas. My knowledge is that he is meditating on the Psalms, mm-hmm. and that not only his idea about the ontological argument, but as you say, this idea of God as a being which none greater can be conceived, this kind of expansive view of God and ultimately heaven. Tell us a little bit about how you, you know, what did you write about that in your doctoral program?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about, you know, going back to read Anselm's ontological argument as opposed to Plantinga's or someone else's or Descartes, is it comes in the context of prayer. So chapters 2 through 4 are all a prayer. He's saying, Lord, you are the being then which nothing, and we believe that that's whom you are. But also in chapter 1, the way the Proslogion starts, it's a especially earnest prayer for illumination and for spiritual cleansing. Mm. And the reason I say ascending toward the beatific vision is the title of the book, Heaven as the Climax of Anselm's Proslogion, is I'm arguing that based upon the explicit statements of Anselm in the Proslogion, in the prologue, in his letters elsewhere, the whole purpose of the book is not just to prove God exists, but to see him, to taste him, to enjoy him. Proving that he exists is just one piece of that effort. And this the longest and most urgent chapter of the book is the first one, where he's saying, that's where he talks about faith seeking understanding. I will not understand unless I first believe. But he's also, he's saying, you know, God, you're this high, majestic God, and I cannot see you because of sin. I'm a sinner, mm-hmm. and I've lost the beatific vision, which is a medieval term just referring to the heavenly sight of God, when we see God with our soul, with the eyes of our soul. And it's said to be the ultimate human experience, the greatest joy imaginable, the thing that we were created to do for all eternity. And Anselm's just crying out, I've lost this. I've lost the whole point of my existence because I'm a fallen human being. I'm sinful. And so he's just crying out, basically, Lord, help me get it again. And the whole book is this sort of progression upwards into his anticipation in the final chapters of that heavenly experience. So there's a profound spiritual undercurrent to the whole book. It's not dry and intellectual and academic. Anselm
doesn't sound like it.
No. He was a monk. Mm-hmm. He was a monk. He spent many, many hours in prayer and reading the Psalms. He read through the Psalms twice a week, the whole Psalter twice a week. He was a Benedictine monk. And his immediate influence was as much spiritual as theological. He was known for his prayers and meditations in those immediately succeeding generations.
And you can read these today, right? They're available?
Right. They're available. They're translated. There's a good translation by Benedicta Ward. And there's a copy of those together with the Proslogion. You can get and read. They're beautiful prayers. Many of them are to the saints. You know, he was a Roman Catholic monk.
Right, right.
And there's much, much value in them. And he really did have that a spiritual focus in the Proslogion. That's what he was trying to do.
You know, often, Gavin, when I talk about philosophy with Christians, they might get the idea that when I talk about Augustine or Aquinas or Anselm or others, that these were philosophers who happened to be Christians.
Mm.
But when I read Anselm and Augustine, and certainly Aquinas as well, these are deeply Christian individuals, and doing philosophy, doing theology is part of their faith, part of who they are. So with Anselm, we're not talking about a medieval guy who was a philosopher who happened to be a Christian. He was a Christian philosopher, even a Christian theologian. Am I correct?
Absolutely. In fact, I would say the very idea of a distinction between philosophy and theology is sort of a modern Western construct that really didn't exist for Anselm, Augustine, Aquinas. And it sort of makes sense why it wouldn't, because materially there's so much overlap between philosophy and theology. But when Anselm was engaging in philosophical questions, you know, he writes about things like the freedom of the will, the problem of human free will, how faith and reason, how do they relate, the doctrine of God, the doctrine of the atonement. He's a theologian first, I think, and then the philosophy is part of that program.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things about his legacy that is well known, and we you mentioned it earlier, faith seeking understanding. I found that a really helpful way to think about this whole area. But that is something he modeled. He started from faith, and he said,
"Faith is a gift, right?
Faith is a gift." And he wrote a letter called On the Incarnation of the Word, where he talks about these things, and he just pours contempt upon what we might think of as philosophy when it's disconnected from theology, people being overly speculative and trusting in their mental powers to figure out the truth. And he just says, you know, this is just craziness. The only proper way to start is with absolute commitment, and you know, the pursuit of understanding doesn't even confirm faith. It's already certain. At one point, he talks about defending the Christian faith, and he says, I'm not defending the Christian faith. That's as crazy as if you were to see me outside Mount Olympus putting stakes into the ground. It's doing just fine on its own. I don't need to defend it. I'm trying to understand it and explicate it and share it with others. And I think that's a helpful way to think even today.
Yeah. I recently wrote, I'm doing a series at this time on my blog, Reflections, kind of introducing people to a brief introduction to some of the Christian classics. I've done Mere Christianity, Confessions, one of Athanasius's work, and I've written a recent one on Anselm's book, Cur Deus Homo, Why the God-Man. And one thing that struck me as I was reviewing the book again and writing this brief introduction, Gavin, is kind of this unique element of Anselm, recognizing that we need to look at the atonement through the lens of the incarnation.
Mm.
Talk to us a little bit about the content of that book and why you see it as important.
Sure. Yeah, that's probably the other area of his thought that's more well known. And I have to say, especially in the times where I've studied the atonement in systematic theology, like take a systematic theology class or something like that, or you read a contemporary book, Anselm is frequently caricatured, I think, in his view of the atonement. A lot of times people simplify what he said and attribute it just to his living in a feudal society. Or they...
F-E-U-D-A-L?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, so you've got sort of a hierarchy in society. And Anselm, and people say, well, Anselm is just viewing the world through that lens, and that's why he's got this God who needs to be appeased. And some people, the trend today, the ethos today in discussions of atonement is very much away from objective accounts of the atonement, and especially those that involve the notion of penal substitution. Mm-hmm. People really don't like that. It's very unpopular in a lot of circles. And so Anselm gets a lot of abuse. Like, look, you know, he caused all these problems in historical theology and the doctrine of atonement. What I found when I read through the Curdeus Homo is a very sensitive and nuanced account of the atonement. And as you say, it's very much drawn out of the incarnation. That's why he titled the book, Why the God-Man. Mm-hmm. So sometimes that view is called the satisfaction view.
Right,
that
right.
Christ's death satisfies the divine honor that is sort of affronted by sin. And so it makes an account for us. But he's very multifaceted. All of the main atonement motifs in discussion today are in Curdeus Homo. He talks about the defeat of the devil at the cross. He talks about the manifestation of God's love at the cross. He even talks about Christ's incarnation as itself a salvific event. It almost sounds like an Eastern Orthodox theologian at times.
Interesting.
He's saying when the God-man assumed a human nature was transformed. It was changed. God spread immortality to the human race. So, you know, I don't want to defend Anselm from every criticism.
Right.
But I do think much would be better if people read him carefully rather than just rely on a summary in contemporary literature, because he often is caricatured.
A question that people sometimes will ask about people like you and I who are interested in historical theology is, why should I care now? What would you say? Why is Anselm important today?
Yeah. Hmm. Well, two reasons that would come to my mind. One is having a high doctrine of the church. If we, and you mentioned this in the last program, if we approach our faith as more than just me and God, but we recognize I'm a part of a family, I'm a part of a community, I've been called into a people, the church, we have to recognize the church isn't just my own local church, nor is it even just all those Christians spread over the planet today. But there's a community that spreads back historically as well. And, you know, we can put it as simply as to say Anselm is our brother in Christ. And we will be with him in heaven, and we are united through Christ. And that alone, I think, should give us some sensitivity to listen, to value his contribution. The other reason, though, is, and we've talked about this a little bit before in the last program, but there's a lot we can learn. Sometimes we tend to think, as we said, you know, we're enlightened. Look at all of our technology today. We don't need the past.
Kind of a chronological snobbery.
Exactly. And C.S. Lewis talked a lot about that. But I think we have so much to learn. Every age has its own blind spots. And in our culture, we have blind spots. And Anselm is one example of the kind of theologian, I think, who can, if you really listen carefully, it's sort of like holding up a mirror, and you start to see areas where, I haven't thought about this enough. And usually it happens with just a little pebble in your shoe, so to speak, where you start to wonder, why does he say that? Mm-hmm. And as you start to chase that question down, you start to realize, okay, this is how he's looking at the world. This is how he's approaching theology. And it's tough to describe the benefit beyond just doing it, but there's just so much to be learned, I think.
You know, I was...
I just wanted you to share a little bit. Maybe you were going to ask him on this anyway, but your thesis in particular was, if I recall, Anselm's view of heaven,
mm-hmm.
or something like that. Can you share with us a few thoughts sure. about what that view was or what's unique about it? Or?
Yeah. There's many things about it, but the one that has I've focused on and I think is mm-hmm. most relevant is his focus on love as one of the most important dynamics of heaven. And that was just helpful to me because I hadn't thought about that very much before Anselm, although Jonathan Edwards preached a sermon called Heaven is a World of Love and has many of the same themes. But what Anselm is saying, and this is at the very end of his book, The Proslogion, is in heaven, we'll fulfill the golden rule perfectly and we'll practice the greatest commandment perfectly because we're perfected. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I will be just as happy at your joy as I will at my own, and so on, and then vice versa. Mm-hmm. And he talks about this sort of infinite multiplication of joy, that the communal experience of heaven is a part of what makes it so, this overflowing joy, is that we love others, and they're also joyful. Wow. And it's a simple idea, but I'd never thought about that. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's a really beautiful aspect of heaven.
Wow. Now, I want to transition to the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, but before I do, you touched on something, Gavin, that struck me, and that is again, when we talk about historical theology, we're talking about our story. I was part of a Reformed church for many years, and in my class, I would have Protestant Reformed Christians come up to me and say, "Why do you talk so much about St. Augustine? He's a Catholic." Mm-hmm. And my response was, Augustine is probably, this might be a bit of an overstatement, but not much. Augustine may be as important to Protestants as he was to Catholics. Mm-hmm. That is, I can't talk about the Protestant Reformation, or maybe even more particularly, my Reformed views, without a backdrop of kind of an Augustinian theology. And so this is kind of our story. I mean, I've had people say, as a Protestant, Ken, you seem to have a particular fascination with the Catholic Church. And I say, you're right, because that's the backdrop of where we come and we look at these issues. So, well, let's talk
about... You'll get some more emails on that.
I will.
Maybe you'll get one or two.
I'm too Catholic friendly is one of the...
A metaphor I've thought about on exactly what you're saying there is of a family photo album.
Yeah.
You know, if you're looking back through a family photo album, there's some pictures that embarrass you, and there's others that you're really proud of.
Right.
But it's still your family. Mm. And yes. I've thought about that with church history, and that's also true, I believe, for medieval Christianity and patristic Christianity, the church fathers, the early church, for Protestants, because that's a part of our story. The reformers were not trying to start over and kickstart a new church. They were trying to reform the church. They drew very much from the early church. Calvin spent a lot of time drawing from the church fathers, for example. At one point he said, all we're trying to do as Protestants is go back to the purity of the fourth century.
Interesting. Well, that's a great topic. Let me introduce another Christian thinker, a Lutheran thinker, Søren Kierkegaard. Joe, his dates are 1813 to 1855. We call him the Melancholy Dane.
Wow.
Had a lot of tragedy in his life. Struggled, I think, at points with kind of mental health issues. But he was an extraordinary individual. Gavin, I wonder if you might talk a little bit about some Kierkegaardian ideas. Let me throw out a couple things to you, and you can kind of pick and choose the way you'd like to respond. I always found it interesting, Kierkegaard's emphasis upon the individual, the personal individual choices that we make in life. I also often think about, you know, he has kind of scorn for an objective idea of truth and often talks about the subjective side. Now, I do at one point want to ask you if maybe Kierkegaard gets a bad rap about some of this, if he isn't kind of overemphasizing for points. And maybe his idea of, you know, self-actualization. Tell us what you find of interest in Kierkegaard, and maybe areas where, you know, I don't take St. Augustine hook, line, and sinker.
Mm-hmm.
There are things in Augustine's view that I differ with. But tell us a little bit about your thinking about this. Maybe the most influential Christian thinker of the 19th century.
Hmm. Yeah, I discovered Kierkegaard in college. I hadn't read him before. I knew of him. I was studying abroad at the University of Oxford, and it's with the tutorial system there. So you go in, and there's the don, or the professor, and it's one-on-one a lot of times. Sometimes there's one other person or two. But for me, it was one-on-one, and it was a course on 19th century philosophy. And I'll never forget walking into this huge office with piles of books everywhere. And he said, okay, who are you? And I told him, and he said, oh, okay, what class is this?
So, I always picture when we go before the Lord, they go, who are you again?
Yeah.
That's not what
I
you want
not.
To hear.
What was your name?
Oh, boy.
And I said, I told him the class, and he said, oh, okay, well, what do you want to do? And I thought, this is great. I can just total freedom here. Mm-hmm. And I basically would take each week I would choose a topic and write a paper on it and then go talk about it with him. And I learned a ton. It was a great, I'm a big believer in that style of education when it's possible. But the first week I chose Kierkegaard, and I pretty much never got off of him. And then I took another class, a directed reading on him the following spring because I just couldn't. I was so captivated. He just gripped me. I read a couple of biographies of him, and his life gripped me. I actually wrote a song. We talked about Dave Matthews last time. So those Dave Matthews chords were put to use. I used to try to write music, hymns and Christian songs and other songs, and I wrote a song about Kierkegaard because his life gripped me so much, the angst driving his life, which is easy to dismiss and just say, oh, yeah, he was just unhealthy or something. But there's something there I think there's profit in really wrestling with and appreciating. He was an amazing man. So his life kind of drew me in, and his ideas. I remember several quotes of his I used to include on some of my emails as a sign-off. But I do think Kierkegaard is one of the most misunderstood people of all time.
Mm.
For example, here's one major issue that we can dive into. He wrote, there's a dual nature to his authorship. He wrote signed works that said Kierkegaard on the title page, and he wrote a lot of pseudonymous works.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hilarious. He's got all these pseudonyms fighting with each other. You know, so most of his famous works, Fear and Trembling, Sickness Unto Death, they're all written by these pseudonyms, Johannes Climacus and all these other people. And they're always picking fights with each other, the pseudonyms. So he's got this whole elaborate sort of strategy for communication, indirect communication. And he wrote three separate works saying, here's how to interpret me. Mm. Read the signed works. That's me. The pseudonymous works are indirect communication. Don't equate me with Climacus and my other pseudonyms. And people just, you know, even very respected popularizers of philosophy, like Walter Kaufman wrote a book, History of Philosophy, and he gets to Kierkegaard and he's quoting the pseudonyms left and right as though it were Kierkegaard. People totally ignore the dual nature of it. Not everybody, but it's commonly mm-hmm. done, and I think we need to appreciate that he didn't, that he wrote with pseudonyms, and just respect his intentions. You know, the other thing is his signed works tended to be more religious. And they're very edifying, works of love, upbuilding discourses. They're basically devotional kinds of books. His pseudonymous works were philosophical. And so the more important writings of his are more theological. His degree from the University of Copenhagen was in theology, not philosophy. He was training to be a pastor. He probably would have become a pastor if not for the Corsair affair, which kind of publicly disgraced mm-hmm. him. He still preached a lot of sermons. So he's really he's a Christian. I would say, like Anselm, he's a Christian first and then a philosopher. And I think he's very misunderstood along those lines today.
Now, some of the statements he makes, and you know, as I read him, there are times where I think he's making a point of emphasis. I mean, he says things like truth is subjective or faith is absurd. I understand those, Gavin, as being more correctives to extreme positions. You know, he's reacting to kind of Hegel's idealism, maybe reacting to an overly intellectualized faith by saying that, you know, faith is a complete leap, if you will. I also must say that I find it very interesting that here is a man who died very early in life. In the 19th century, he's virtually unknown. And in fact, most of his books are self-published. But in the 20th century, his books become the rage of, you know, European philosophy. But again, he is, I think, and I agree with you, he is first a Christian. And he is an individual that kind of speaks to us on a variety of levels.
Yes. Yeah, and I think, you know, some of those statements where he gets a lot of bad rap for, truth is subjectivity, for example, I do think it's easy to misunderstand him, and a lot of people today say that he's basically an irrationalist. He believes truth is ultimately irrational.
Totally fideist, no reason.
Exactly. But, you know, as I've gone back, and I wrote a blog post on this once, basically, is Kierkegaard an irrationalist? And I just compiled a number of quotes where he says, truth is not absurd in itself. It appears so to us because we are finite and temporal. The metaphor I used is sort of like, you know, the fact that dogs see the world in black and white doesn't mean it is black and white. Faith appears as a paradox to us because of our status. We don't see from the point of view of eternity as God does. And he, in his book, Concluding Unscientific Postscript, he develops this point, and he basically says the reason faith, you know, truth comes to us as a paradox in the incarnation is because of our status. It's not that that's what it is in itself. And there's many times where he says truth to God, truth is a system. It is a perfectly logical, coherent system to God. It's just not to us. And I think a lot of times he's misunderstood along those lines. And people read the statement, truth is subjectivity, as if he were saying truth is subjective.
Relativistic.
Yeah. But I don't think that's what he means. I think you put it exactly right. He's reacting to his context. You know, at one point he says, the central problem of my authorship is how to be a Christian in Christendom. Because he lived with the Lutheran Danish state church, where everybody's a Christian, you're baptized, that takes care of it. Yeah. And he's passionately reacting against that, and he's calling for personal faith and inwardness and the inward appropriation in the heart of the Christian faith. And I think that's his focus, and I think that's the best way to understand him.
You're hitting on something that has been a subject of discussion among us for some time. Hugh Ross has written a book called Beyond the Cosmos, and he communicates the idea that there may be concepts, teachings of Scripture that to us don't make sense or we can't get our mind around, but from the perspective of God living in, and of course, as a scientist, he puts it in these terms, living in a higher dimension, those are perfectly logical. But for us, they're not. And in fact, even at the conference that we went to recently, the AMP conference, he made a statement to the effect that the fact that there is within Scripture principles or teachings, doctrinal positions, that we can't get our mind around, that we can't fully comprehend. I would imagine free will versus predestination might be one of them.
Joe has that one down.
Yeah. that this is, in fact,
the next podcast.
Evidence supporting the truth of Scripture in contrast to other books of, you know, religious books, which are written all from the perspective of humanity. And so they don't contain these contradictions because they're made up with from the mind of man.
Right.
I'm just kind of interested to find that Kierkegaard apparently is sensitive to this kind of thinking and this.
Yeah.
Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
It does. And it reminds me of the C.S. Lewis quote, and we're going to talk about Lewis too, where he says, "One of the reasons I believe in Christianity is because I never could have made it up."
Yeah.
It has that sort of ring of authenticity. Right. Like, doesn't seem like somebody invented this.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I do appreciate Kierkegaard in this sense of that he points us to the sort of radical, all-in, deeply felt, deeply inward, existential nature of faith. And so it should be, because our faith is in an incarnation. The core of our faith is the notion that God became a man. Mm-hmm. Well, if there's anything that we can't understand fully, that we could even invent, surely that is a very mysterious truth. And if that's the essence of our faith, the main miracle of Christianity that we believe in, surely there will be a sort of, struggle and angst at times involved in faith, and it won't be this cold, logical thing. And I think Kierkegaard points us to that.
And that's a good reason we should care about him today, you know, that he is a person who can speak to us. Well, let's talk about one more person. On Imago Dei, we talk a lot about C.S. Lewis because, his book Mere Christianity was selected as the most influential Christian book of that century, and mm-hmm. I think you could make a case that he's the most influential apologist of that era. And
20th century.
Mm-hmm. That's to say nothing of his writing, you know, children's stories and, his space trilogy. Joe, Lewis's dates are 1898 to 1963, and I remember reading in the early 80s Peter Kraft's Between Heaven and Hell, where he has... Mm-hmm. Peter Kraft is this very clever Catholic philosopher. He has Lewis, John F. Kennedy, and Aldous Huxley meeting after death but before eternity. And Lewis, of course, is the Christian. Kennedy is kind of the secular humanist. And the other individual,
Huxley
is the pantheist. And they have this...
They all died on the same day, right?
And they all died on the same day. In fact, very close to the same hour.
Wow.
We have talked a bit about Lewis, but... What is it, first of all, Gavin? What kinds of arguments about Christianity or ways of thinking about the truth of Christianity that are in Lewis? What are those things that kind of resonate with you, if you will?
Yeah, one of the biggest ones is the argument from desire, which he teases out in many writings. You know, one of his most famous quotes is the one about, if I find in me a desire that no experience in this world can satisfy, the most logical explanation is I was made for another world. It's a famous quote. I think it's from Mere Christianity, perhaps.
I think that's right.
But he also makes that same sort of appeal in fiction. And I have to say, one of my favorite passages in all of literature is Puddleglum in The Silver Chair, when one of the Chronicles of Narnia, a number of characters are underground, and there's a sorceress, a witch, who's trying to convince them that what she calls the overworld, above ground, doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. They just dreamed it up. And Puddleglum, his response to that, in addition to stamping on the fire that's part of the sorcery, is based, and he's a very pessimistic character. He's based on Lewis's Gardener.
He's Puddle Glum, after all.
Yeah, exactly. Well named. But his response is basically to say, well, if that's true, then our fake world is a lot better than the real world. Mm. And he says, we're just babies making up a game then, but we can make up a better game than the world that actually exists. And I just love that response. I just think it's compelling to me. It rings true. It's, you know, I've thought about that. It's some people, in fact, in one of his letters, C.S. Lewis refers to that as kind of an ontological argument of sorts, kind of mm-hmm. the argument from the mind to the external reality. And I think it's a good point. If in a nihilistic worldview, the ideas of Christianity, heaven, objective good, God, those ideas are more weighty, more substantive, more beautiful than the world that really exists. And there's an appeal there. You know, you talked about truth, goodness, beauty earlier. That's not just an appeal to truth. There's an appeal to goodness and beauty there. Mm-hmm. And to me, at any rate, that really strikes home and it resonates.
Now, one topic that we've talked a lot about, both in our earlier podcast of Straight Thinking and now in Imago Dei, Gavin, we talked about the argument from reason, this idea that, you know, the source and foundation of reason cannot be adequately explained purely naturalistically, that reason points to God and that evolution may even cloud the waters, according to Plantica. It does seem that Christian apologetics with Lewis, but before that, even maybe in Kant, maybe in Plato, for that matter, that reason requires something beyond the purely natural explanation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just reading, or I mentioned earlier, I'm listening to an audiobook of That Hideous Strength, which is one of Lewis's books right now. I tend to just, sometimes people ask, how many times have you read that book? And the truth is, I've never stopped. I just kind of cycle through it at slower or faster paces, but it's never completely gone. And I love the character Mark in that book and the transformation he goes through, where he becomes a Christian, basically, or it's implied he's moving in that direction. And at one crucial point, he experiences a sort of spiritual attack, and he starts to lose trust in his ability to think and to arrive at truth with his brain. And it says, though he was a materialist, he had always inconsistently believed in the freedom of his own will and never taken it and always taken it for granted, and says he starts to wonder, if nothing exists but nature, why should I trust that I have a free will, and why should I trust the thoughts in my brain? Mm-hmm. Why are they anything more than simply chemical phenomena? And it sort of haunts him. And so again, it's the narrative portrayal of this argument that has an appeal to it, I think. And I think it's a well-done appeal. And I think there's a good case to be made there. Tim Keller makes a similar case in The Reason for God. You know, if the only explanation for our existence is time plus chance plus matter, if we're just here based upon what made our ancestors survive, survival of the fittest, well, what makes our ancestors survive might not be truth. It probably mostly will be truth. Truth is valuable. Truth has survival value, but not every time. Sometimes truth doesn't help you survive. So why should we assume that we can access the truth if the only explanation for our existence is survival of the fittest? I think that's a good argument, and I think Lewis makes it very well.
It's interesting to me that both Lewis and Tolkien, who were friends at Oxford and had quite a influence upon each other, both of them are soldiers. Both of them are first lieutenants in the British Army in World War I. In fact, Lewis said that poetry kind of helped him to, maybe today we might say it helped him to kind of cope with his post-traumatic stress disorder, that the images of death and destruction that he saw and experienced. Lewis was wounded severely in World War I, and even Tolkien had trench fever, was very, very ill. These are two men that come out of World War I. Tolkien, a Catholic, Lewis, Tolkien has an influence in Lewis becoming first a theist and then later a Christian, an Anglican. It seems to me, Gavin, that one of the differences between the writings of Lewis and Tolkien and the writings, let's say, of atheist existentialist following World War II is that they have a real place for evil in the world. In their writings, they engage evil, and that evil has to be fought. What you like Tolkien? What impresses you about the fictional writings of maybe Lewis and Tolkien?
Yeah, well, what you just said is actually the thing that I've thought about the most with Tolkien: the nature of evil. The whole plot structure of The Lord of the Rings is so interesting in that the basic thing that needs to happen is not good to triumph over evil. Good just needs to resist evil, that is, not use the ring. And if it does that, evil will destroy itself. And that he wrote that kind of story rather than a story where the good guys, through some ingenious strategy, find the ring and use the ring and win, is very telling about his view of the seductive nature of evil, how easily seduced we are. I think, and his portrayal of good and evil in The Lord of the Rings, I've often wanted to write on this, and I haven't had the time. What do we learn about good versus evil from The Lord of the Rings? I think there's a lot. The character Gollum is so nuanced. You know, there's good and evil. He's kind of it's so different from like a James Bond film or something like that, where you've got good guys and bad guys, and they're so plastic. In Lord of the Rings, it's very realistic, and I appreciate the way he describes. At one point, he describes evil as basically creatures not wanting to be creatures, not wanting to accept their status as creatures, but wanting to be the creator. And he talks about Sauron and some of the other characters not being content to serve, but wanting to be served, and the desire for power. And I think that's a very insightful and creative way to describe evil that connects with a lot of people today. You know, if we just define evil as breaking the rules, well, that's true, but we might not feel the horror of it quite as much. No one can read The Lord of the Rings and not feel the horror of evil.
Yeah.
No one can read that and think, oh, it's a small thing to be evil. It's terrible. And the same is true for Lewis in That Hideous Strength. The evil characters are hilarious. They're these, you know, bizarre characters that very creatively done, but Lewis portrays them as just absolutely, there's totally joyless. There's no joy. It's all about power. Mm. It's all about competition. It's all about one-upping each other. And then the good characters are so beautiful in how they're portrayed. And I just think we can learn from Lewis and Tolkien about the importance of portraying, especially in a postmodern setting, a post-Christian setting, portraying the things we believe in creative ways that connect, and not just sort of rehashing our traditional vocabulary, but you know, helping people feel the truths of theology that we're talking about, in this case, good and evil, how beautiful good is and how horrible evil is. Lewis, you know, in That Hideous Strength, he portrays good as just the opposite of evil in Tolkien. It's accepting our creaturely status. The whole goal of the evil people in that book is to separate the mind from the body so you can live on forever.
Yeah.
And the good people are those who, you know, they're the basic characteristic of that house, it's called the house at St. Anne's, is they accept their status as bodily creatures, and they don't try to fight that. And he says that's a big part of what makes good good and evil evil is, will we say to God, okay, I'm what you made me to be, rather than, no, I want to be what I want to be. Mm. It's just a very creative way of getting into the distinction between good and evil. So I've learned a lot from him.
Last question as we look at near the end of our program here. Gavin, is it okay to disagree with Anselm and Kierkegaard and Lewis and still appreciate them? Can I pick and choose?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly. I mean, I think anyone who's thoughtful and engages thinkers like that will certainly disagree with things. I think my encouragement to those who are studying them and learning from them, reading their books, is to kind of give it time to get to the disagreement and not instinctively, because sometimes the learning comes, you know, Lewis himself said once, the very person who passionately argued against you is often found years later to have been influenced by what you said.
Ah.
And I think that's true. I think a lot of times we really are influenced from the engagement. And I think in To Kill a Mockingbird is one of my favorite books, the character Atticus Finch. I think that book is all about not being prejudiced, basically. And what Atticus Finch says about you never really understand a person until you crawl inside their skin and see the world through their eyes really is an important habit and value for all of life, including the learning, including the intellectual sphere. Being able to crawl into the skin of an Anselm or Kierkegaard or Lewis or whoever and say, how did the world make sense to them? Mm. Why was this reasonable to them? And if you can do that and hang with them through that process for a while, ultimately, certainly you'll disagree with things here or there. But there's a great benefit and much to be learned. And a lot of times, that's where I think the greatest influence can be had.
Very good. Gavin, it's been a real pleasure to have you on with us, and continue to appreciate your work as a visiting scholar here. And we'll, of course, be interested to see where your ministry and future travels take you. And so, Joe, I'm going to turn it back
right,
over to
yeah.
you.
I guess, Gavin, my comment is I wouldn't dare disagree too much with those guys, or you might end up in hell, because it looks like, based on some of your academic papers, you believe in hell. we might mention some of your works. You've been working on a couple of books, Ascending Toward the Beatific Vision, Heaven as the Climax of Anselm's Proslogion. Is that something that is coming out soon? Can you mention that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that one's in the edits with Brill right now.
Okay.
I don't have a date, but probably sometime later this year that'll hit the shelves.
All right. Then another one, First and Second Kings, a 12-week study, Knowing the Bible. Looks like that has a 2017 date on it.
That's right. That'll be out in April of this year, and it can be very pre-ordered on Amazon already.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to that. You've done a number of academic papers and presentations. I was kidding about the hell part, but it looks like you've presented in that context of defending hell. So glad to know that you believe in such a place.
Yeah. I'm with C.S. Lewis on that one, where he says it would be nice if we could get rid of that idea in a way, but I don't think we can.
All right. Well, as Ken said, a pleasure to have you with us, part of the Visiting Scholar Program here at Reasons to Believe. All right, well, that is going to wrap it up for this podcast. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Imago Dei.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.